Banks, bonds, and good jobs, kind of an economic trifecta on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In San Francisco today, the studios of KQED. Once again, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you along, everybody. Today's installment of Capitalism Always Finds a Way, it always does, is brought to you by the American banking sector. After years of saying that their profits have been hamstrung by post-financial crisis regulations, turns out the big Wall Street banks are on a remarkably good tear. Morgan Stanley turned in a better-than-expected quarterly profit today. That follows similar news from Goldman Sachs yesterday. Both banks reported a more than 50% rise in profits, 50% rise in profits, driven by a rebound in trading. J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, and Bank of America all beat analyst expectations. All in all, quite the earnings season on Wall Street. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports now on how banks are making money in the era of Dodd-Frank.
Think of a bank as a manufacturer. It takes in raw material, money, mostly in the form of deposits, and turns it into products it can sell, like loans, credit cards, and securities. Analyst Richard Beauvais with Rafferty Capital Markets says because interest rates on deposits are so low, that raw material is cheap.
So the difference between the cost of the money and what they're selling the money at, you know, in the case of Bank of America, is about $32 billion.
Meanwhile, a lot of the costs that had been eroding that profit since the financial crisis, lawsuits, government fines, losses from bad loans, have been shrinking.
And as a result of that, you come out with a pretty big profit.
The good news, says analyst Stephen Bigger at Argus Research, is that profit appears to be coming from traditional parts of the business, like loans and fixed income sales and trading, not the kind of creative financial engineering that caused the financial crisis.
This is not derivatives or anything exotic. This is, in some cases, bread and butter banking that's doing well.
And this comes in spite of complaints that the Dodd-Frank financial regulations enacted after the crisis have made it harder for banks to make money. Peter Conti Brown is a financial historian and professor at the Wharton School.
I think we should take with a grain of salt any complaint that, oh, the regulations have choked out banks' ability to make profits. What we're seeing today is that that's not really true at all.
But Conti Brown says the allegations of account fraud against Wells Fargo make him worry banks are still getting creative in ways we haven't found out about yet. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
A barrel of crude closed today at $51 a barrel, up about 2.5%. Good news for the producing nations of the world, including us. But with oil still well off its most recent highs, not really all that great. I offer that as a way into this next story. Saudi Arabia went to market today with a $17.5 billion bond offering, the first time that it has sold debt into the global economy and the biggest bond sale from an emerging economy ever. We sent Marketplace's Jed Kim out to get the whys and wherefores.
It's a question of timing. Why are the oil-rich Saudis doing this now?
They're basically running out of money.
David Ottaway is a Middle East fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center. With oil's huge price decline, Saudi Arabia has been running budget deficits for years.
They've gone through close to $200 billion in their reserves, and they're trying to avoid continuing just drawing down on the reserves to cover their deficit spending.
Joe Gagneau is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says Saudi Arabia had recently splurged on major developments.
Housing and highways and infrastructure, hospitals and schools and petrochemical plants and stuff. That ramped up just before the oil price collapsed. Bad timing for them.
The kingdom decided to overhaul its economy, austerity policies, selling off part of its state-owned oil company, and now this bond sale. It is a great time to be selling, says Raman Srivastava with Standish Mellon.
We've been talking about it here as them tapping into an oasis of demand. And really, it's coming from, the thirst for diversification, liquidity, yield. It's coming from the fact that oil prices are stable to slightly rising.
Plus, other country-issued bonds have done well recently. Argentina earlier this year offered $16.5 billion in bonds. And with Saudi Arabia's ready access to oil, the bonds are pretty low risk. Srivastava says he expects the sale to go quite well. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
All right, so let's move out of banks and finance now into healthcare. Emergency rooms and hospitals in general are some of the most expensive places to get health care. And in fact, one of the big selling points of the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, was the idea that if people get health insurance, they would have better preventative care and end up in those costly emergency rooms a lot less. There is some data out today, though, that shows something of the opposite. People with insurance are taking advantage of more preventative care. They are also, though, still going to the ER. From the Health Desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein asks why.
In 2008, Oregon held a lottery to enroll people in its Medicaid program. A team of economists was watching closely. The group, co-led by MIT's Amy Finkelstein, found people who got Medicaid ended up using the ER 40% more than the people who didn't get insurance.
At least as an economist, I don't find this so surprising or puzzling. I understand that there was a hope that somehow that covering the low-income uninsured with Medicaid would get them out of the emergency room and into primary care, and that would have been nice, but it turns out the world isn't so simple or easy.
In a prior study, the team found when you give people insurance, they'll use it more. Doctor's visits, flu shots, prescriptions, even hospitalizations. The new study, out today, backs that up.
Regardless of how well people are insured, people are still going to depend on the emergency department as a core place to receive care.
University of California, San Francisco emergency department doctor Renee Shaw.
And we also have noticed that as our patient population gets older, we have more complex diseases. There's higher acuity things presenting to the ED.
Shaw says also patients' doctors send them to the ER. And sometimes people can't get an appointment quick enough, so that's why they end up there. Here's the bottom line, though, says Harvard economist Kate Baker, the other co-lead on the study.
Insurance makes the emergency department affordable. People didn't go because of the big bill they got when they showed up. Now that it's affordable, people go more.
If the goal is to keep people out of the emergency room, Baker says the time has come for a new strategy. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Slow start, slightly better finish on Wall Street. Today we'll have the details when we do the numbers. The third and final presidential debate is tonight in Las Vegas, the real beginning of the home stretch and the most divisive election in modern memory. The divisions we've seen so far have been by and large predictable. Voters split along racial and gender lines, but there have been some less predictable divisions as well, like education. For the first time in half a century, a Democrat could win the majority of white voters with college degrees. That education gap is an especially big factor in North Carolina, where college-educated whites have long voted Republican, but could help give Hillary Clinton that state come November. Marketplace's Rima Kreis reports now from Raleigh that that shift says as much about the candidates as it does about the changing economics of North Carolina.
I meet up with Kelly Hollis in the midst of her daily after-school drill.
Good to meet you.
Hi. Good to meet you. I'm Kelly.
This is Lauren.
10-year-old Lauren runs into the house to get ready for soccer practice. 13-year-old Riley, already sweaty and mud-stained, takes a break before soccer round two.
He has his second practice this afternoon, so it's a busy afternoon for us.
Inside, Hollis immediately points out a glossy postcard laying on her kitchen table.
I think the first Hillary ad that has come in the mail.
Oh, did you just get that today?
Yesterday. It came yesterday.
Why is this Clinton ad such an event?
I mean, as a registered Republican, never get marketing materials from the Democratic Party.
She's still a registered Republican, but she's getting marketing materials because she was so infuriated by Trump after watching the first debate that she signed on to support Clinton.
I wasn't a fan of Hillary Clinton, but when I realized that that was my only option, a protest vote didn't sit well with me, if that makes sense.
It's not just Trump's character that turns Hollis off. She says his policies on immigration, taxes, and trade will hurt the economy.
I was driving through rural western North Carolina a couple weeks ago, and, you know, it was just like Trump sign after Trump sign after Trump sign. And I just wanted to stop and, like, scream, he is not going to help you.
Voters like Hollis, white and college-educated, have long been the Republicans' winning formula in North Carolina. They went for Bush, McCain, and in 2012, 70% of college-educated white voters backed Romney. But a recent poll shows that's nearly flipped. 60% of those voters are now backing Clinton. white voters without college degrees are moving around, too. They're far more likely to back Trump, says Michael Bitzer, a political science professor at Catawba College near Charlotte.
We've talked about the gender gap. We've talked about the God gap. I think this education gap is really going to be driving a lot of what we're seeing, particularly here in North Carolina.
It's driving the Clinton campaign. It has three times as many field offices in the state as Trump and has collected reams of data it can use to target those white educated voters. Dan Cannonan heads up the campaign in the state.
We look at where we need to mobilize people. We look at where we need to persuade people. We know essentially what markets to be in and down really to the precinct level.
The campaign and its supporters also will have blanketed the state with an estimated $20 million in ads by Election Day. Trump still lags far behind in ad spending, but has moved more staff to North Carolina. And both candidates say they'll visit the state after the debate.
North Carolina is in play in part because of a lot of demographic changes that have made it just a different state than it was even 4 years ago and the 4 years before that.
Different in that half of North Carolina's registered voters now come from somewhere else. With one of the fastest growing economies in the country, the state has become a magnet for young, well-educated workers who are flocking to cities like Charlotte and Raleigh for jobs in banking, tech, research. I went looking for transplants at World of Beer, a bar just outside of Raleigh in a city called Cary. It's spelled C-A-R-Y, and people joke it stands for Containment Area for Relocated Yankees, like 37-year-old David Kalbflesh.
Yeah, I moved here from Boston because it's easy to get a software job here, and I grew up in Kentucky, so this is a lot like my hometown of Louisville with a much better economy.
Kalbflesh says he's undecided and may not vote for president. His friend, Molly Miles, who will be voting, also moved here for a tech job. She's 28, from Texas, and grew up in a super Republican family.
Very conservative Christian values.
Miles remembers when she was in second grade and supported Bill Clinton as part of a school assignment.
And my mom was like, no. And like, we had a talk about how that was not okay. And we don't vote for Democrats because they reward lazy people.
These days, her mom bombards her on social media instead.
There's definitely been a lot of yay Trump Facebook posts,
which Miles deletes. She says she's registering as an independent. And Kelly Hollis, the suburban mom from Raleigh, will be giving up her Republican status and joining Miles.
I don't think that the Republican Party really represents my values anymore.
If Clinton keeps her hold on people like Hollis and Miles, she just may score a rare victory among college-educated voters in this southern swing state. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
We've been digging into the results from our most recent survey, the Marketplace Edison Research Economic Poll, this week. And today, we're going to dig into what voters in this country think about jobs, specifically what makes a good one. If you heard the program yesterday, you heard Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Kaine's political answer to that question. We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman at our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting to go out and see what regular people think.
Pay and benefits are top of mind for a group of women gathered on a stormy weeknight recently at a local union office on the outskirts of Portland.
So the stores have in-store coupons.
They're here for a couponing class offered by the group Oregon Tradeswomen, with all sorts of tips about online discounts and printable coupons to save, save, save. A.J. Banuelos is 39, a single mom with three kids. She's been a union construction worker for 5 years now.
I was a stay-at-home mom, and I'd done a lot of clerical work and retail.
How does what you do now compare?
An hour, I make $27.72. The highest I made prior to joining the trades was $12 an hour. Now I make a livable wage. I'm able to provide for my family. I value my benefits. My medical, my dental.
In our Marketplace Edison Research Economic Poll, people ranked health benefits as the top attribute of a good job. A.J. Banuelos says she's also glad not to be bouncing between low-wage jobs anymore. And our survey found that having a job that you can stay at for many years is most important to workers without a college degree. Like auto mechanic Anatoly Lobasyuk. He took a job at an auto shop right out of high school, and he's still there 10 years later. He says it's all about
treating employees properly. If the employer doesn't treat you well, you're going to go somewhere else.
That jibes with another finding in our poll. People said a top priority in a good job is a good working environment. In fact, it's significantly more important than a retirement plan, full-time hours, or paid time off. Peter Sather would agree. He's 23, works as a waiter in New York City, and has a second job tutoring foreign languages.
I've worked a lot of jobs where, you know, you have to build up some mental fortitude just to get there. Then I've also had a couple jobs where I was excited to go to work. I worked at a Vietnamese restaurant. Just the atmosphere was so amazing, and it was like, oh, yay, get to go see everyone.
According to our survey, it's also important to work at a place where you feel valued. Two-thirds of respondents say that's essential in a good job. Phoenix Clark works as an online fraud analyst in Portland and makes a good salary in the 100,000-plus range. I caught up with him at a local fitness club where he also teaches Zumba classes several nights a week.
I feel like I'm very lucky to finally found a company that fits my personality, that has that corporate ethics that you want, and that treats us all like owners. And I love the fact that the schedule is flexible so that we're all encouraged to have a personal life, a family life.
Having a flexible schedule, by the way, that isn't high on the list of workplace priorities in our poll. Only 40% of respondents say providing flexible working hours is essential for a good job. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If you're the polling data type, you can see all the results of our survey. It's at marketplace.org. Coming up.
Well, it's gotten to the point where there are actually sponsored cubers who get flown to competitions.
Inside the world of competitive Rubik's Cube solving. Seriously. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up 40 points today, about 0.2%, finished at 18,202. The NASDAQ ticked up 2 points. That's less than 0.1%, 52.46. The S&P 500 nudged up 4 points, about 0.2% there as well, 21.44. Banks continue to lead the field. Morgan Stanley up 1.8% today. Goldman Sachs up 1%. J.P. Morgan Chase up 0.9% today. Oil services company Halliburton spouted 4% higher after it announced a surprise profit. Schlumberger pumped up 2.5%. Bond prices, well, they rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury notes thus fell to 1.74%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The ticker symbol of the week so far is NFLX. Netflix up 19% yesterday, another 3% today on a heartbeat on earnings Monday after the close. The win was at least in part because of the company's investment in original content, things like Stranger Things and Narcos and Orange is the New Black. That's a lesson that other non-traditional media companies, Amazon among them, have learned well at the expense, perhaps, of what we used to call just straight-up TV. Marketplace's Sally Herships has that one.
Welcome to Hawkins. It's a tiny town in Indiana, the setting for Netflix hit show Stranger Things.
I don't know the worst thing that's ever happened here in the 4 years I've been working here. It was when an owl attacked Eleanor Gillespie's head because it thought that her hair was a nest.
A small boy has gone missing, there's a strange creature in the woods, and people in the town are disappearing, one by one. It's practically impossible not to binge watch. Great for viewers, but if you make TV...
Well, the jungle just got a lot meaner.
Mark Robichaud is editorial director of Multichannel News. He says Netflix is expected to spend $6 billion this year on content, and Amazon more than $1.5 billion, which ups the ante for traditional TV and cable networks.
Not just by raising the price, but by sucking up the best talent.
Robichaud says if you can't find writers, it's harder to create mega hits.
They're not just falling off the tree.
But more shows means it's also harder to get viewers. Sam Craig is director of NYU's Entertainment, Media, and Technology program. He says online content producers have a big leg up.
Netflix's advantage and Amazon's advantage is that they've got lots of consumer data that give them insights into what people want to see.
To fight back, companies like Comcast and Virgin are selling smaller packages and adding Netflix, like a channel. But making hits can be expensive. And, Bark Robichaux says, a gamble. The more original content they produce, the more likely it is that companies like Amazon and Netflix will have to raise their prices. An idea much less popular than Stranger Things. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
All right, let's do a quick radio game here, shall we? I'm going to play you a sound. You tell me what it is. Here you go. That is a Rubik's Cube. Specifically, it's a Rubik's Cube being solved by a guy who actually knows how to do it. Ian Scheffler is his name. His new book about that oh-so-frustrating, for me anyway, little toy is called Cracking the Cube. Ian, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Kai.
What was it about Rubik's Cube that got you hooked? Because this thing came out way before you were born, man.
Yeah, that's true. I was born in 1990, so by that time the Cube was all but dead. But my fascination didn't start until I went to this really unusual summer camp. On the first day, I sat next to this kid, and he was doing something under the table with his hands, and it was making a weird clicking noise, and I didn't know what was going on. And then he pulled his hands out, and he'd solved a Rubik's Cube. And I found out years later he was actually the greatest Rubik's Cube solver on the planet.
Wow. We should get it out of the way early that for all of its, I don't want to say frivolous, right, because you guys are really serious about it, but for all of its gameness, for all the fact that it is, in essence, a game and a sport, there's actually like serious math and algorithms and scientific theory behind it, sort of.
The branch of mathematics that most closely relates to Rubik's Cube is called group theory, which most people would never encounter in their ordinary lives. But actually, everyone does this when you're just, say, getting a sandwich out of the fridge, because you're opening the fridge door, which could be the first operation. You're getting out your sandwich, which is the second operation, and then you are reversing the first operation by closing the door. And what that does, both in getting your sandwich out and in solving a Rubik's Cube, is it allows you to do something without destroying something that you want to preserve. For instance, you don't want to take a pickaxe to the fridge because you want to have a fridge afterward.
Right.
In the same way, if you already have part of the cube solved, but you want to work on another part, you might have to modify that part that is solved, but you want to make sure it goes back to being solved afterward.
Right. And that was the part that always got me. When I was watching my brother solve these things, he would do it, and I would say, but wait, you just wrecked the part? Yeah, and he's like, no, I'm going to fix it. And it got me. There is actually a World Cube Association. You guys have championships and stuff. Can you make a living cubing like you can playing, any of the video games out there?
Well, it's gotten to the point where there are actually sponsored cubers who get flown to competitions and they represent certain brands of puzzle. They like wear shirts that look like NASCAR jerseys.
Wow.
So it's ramping up, and it remains to be seen exactly where this is going to go. Is it going to turn into the spelling bee where everybody sort of tunes in once a year? Is it going to be like semi-professional? It remains to be seen.
A word here about Erno Rubik, the Hungarian guy who actually invented this thing. You met him.
Yeah, he's a bit like the Willy Wonka of Eastern Europe. He's extremely reclusive and really brilliant. He keeps very close track of all kinds of things going on in the world. I mean, the range of his influences spans from, you know, Da Vinci to Isaac Asimov. He's very tuned into modern art. He's the scion of one of Hungary's greatest engineers and also a poet. So he's literally the union of art and science. It makes total sense that he would have invented this.
Huh. Did Mr. Rubik get rich off this cube? Did he make like a gazillion dollars?
Yeah, so I mean, he's made a lot of money, enough to be comfortable, but he's an extremely modest man. I mean, I was told by one of his members of his inner circle that he easily could have bought probably half of the whole country of Hungary at the time the cube was popular, but that's not what he's about. He's very modest, and there's also the sort of piracy issue, because the Rubik's Cube is obviously fairly easy to imitate, and you know, there's been enough pirated cubes that no one even knows how many cubes there are.
You say at the end of this book that you believe anyway that the cube is coming back.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really indisputable. You can also just look at sales figures and the commercial side of it, whether that means, you know, its appearance in ad campaigns or movies. I mean, Logic, who's a rising star in the world of hip-hop, he's so into Rubik's Cubes that he has a track about it on his new album.
Ian Scheffler's book is called Cracking the Cube. Ian, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
There's an excerpt of Ian's book at our website. It is marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, two quick items, actually. Number one, this day in history, October the 19th, 1987. Anybody? Anyone? Black Monday. The Dow dropped 22% that day. That's like the blue chips falling 4,000 points today. So, yeah, things aren't so bad, are they? Item number two, circling back to Sally's piece about Netflix and the future of television, there are reports today that Google has gotten CBS to sign on for its web-based television service. That would be a big deal. CBS has always been a tough sell digital distributionally, and there's football involved with CBS as well. Also, while we're on it, Apple TV. Whatever happened with that anyway? All right, we got to go. The Dow up 40 points today, 0.2%, finished at 18,202. The NASDAQ up 2 points, less than 0.1%, 5246. The S&P 500 up 4 points, 0.2%, 21.44. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.